Are you running?
I am. I just have to... This is the second session of the interview with Kay Gapin. It's now the 21st of March, 1988. And I said to you that that David Cronin this morning had been saying what a serious situation the libraries were in and what an impossible job you had.
Bless his heart. He actually helped last year. The physics faculty went to him and said that the collections were just falling apart, and he put in $50,000 of money that he had. And but we've described what's happening from the large-scale perspective of inflation. We've described it from what we know is happening with the value of the dollar abroad. We've described it from the perspective of the individual faculty member who can't find what he or she wants in the collection, so we have case studies of that. We've got letters from whole departments about collection needs that they have, not to mention staffing needs. There are probably 30 fewer staff people here now than there were 10 years ago, and yet the campus is growing. Or it has grown in faculty and student body. And system staff are caught, I think, between competing financial needs. And they are going to not put library collections at the top.
They're not.
Not. We think that we've probably lost almost half the purchasing dollar value of the dollar that we spend on collections. Mm-hmm. And so that's at least $1 million that we've lost in buying power over the last 3 years. And the collection increase this year for the whole system was $1 million. And we got in the general library system 340,000 or something of that. If you add health sciences and law, because they get their collection budget separately, we're up to about $4.5 million in the collection budget, and 300,000 is a drop in the bucket when you look at what's happening. We're not buying I think we probably have on lists on hand orders from faculty members or from bibliographers for, you know, 40,000-50,000 monographs that we're not buying this year. And we're about steady state in the serials titles now. We've canceled over 2,000 titles, and now we don't add unless we cancel. The net effect is, if there's any growth, it's very small growth, a few hundred titles a year. And that on a campus of this size is just silly. And so the collections are the collections are not excellent anymore. And I think probably now they're not even adequate. And the other thing, Laura, is that we're not, in trying to hold the camp together on the instructional and research programs that are historically founded, if you look at new things like robotics, anything in the sciences that's new, there's a big new folklore program. So it's even in the humanities and the social sciences. We're not buying in new areas. So we don't have the collection to fall back on that's been built over time. Mm-hmm. And we're not building the collection now, which is going to be useful for today or tomorrow. And that's a very hard thing I've decided to describe. You either have to believe it's important or you don't. And there's not a consensus that I can see that it's important. The other thing that's happening is that campus overhead money from the grants. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you say that the grant revenue continues to go up over $200 million last year. What we get of that doesn't go up. And I think that's because more and more the campus runs on soft money. There are more normal ongoing operations running on soft money from the grant overhead. And there's not a lot there to reallocate. I honestly think that's true. Although the campus, too, is faced with a conundrum for libraries because we've gotten started on this automation project. And that, excuse me, that takes $1.5 million a year or so to run. Well, that's not that's stable, and it's not going to grow at the pace that the collection budget is going, but it has added on to the support for the library, but not in the area of collections, so that neither one of them are funded. We ran NLS at a deficit last year, and now it's funded for this year, but we're still almost $1 million short of the base budget that's needed to operate it from year to year. And system staff for the biennium aren't going to look at automation funding for libraries. So there won't be any money coming from the legislature for that. It means the campus will have to pay for that. I don't have anything to reallocate into it. So the campus has to pick that up as well as trying to deal with the collection budget. And I don't understand. I honestly do not understand the collection support, because you can't make up books out of thin air. You know? We borrow, but that's not what it takes when you've got somebody who needs something today. And that's just, I don't know, if the Chancellor is successful, I'll just bow to the East and with thanks. But if she's not consistent and successful in her support, we're just slipping right now into mediocrity so fast for the collections.
And Dave Cronin said that the Madison Library is the base library for the whole system, so yeah. that it's not doing anybody else any good either.
No. We lend on from the general library system, not counting the health sciences and engineering library. We lend about 100,000 things a year. And that doesn't count all of the photocopies of articles that are just Xeroxed and sent out. And 40% of that lending goes to system libraries. Mm. When we cut titles, we're really cutting them for the whole state. And I think Milwaukee doesn't have the collection, and nobody else has. They can't borrow from each other. They can only borrow from us. And so if we don't have it, nobody has it. And then that increases the cost of everybody to go out and borrow it from somebody else, or they just do without, or they do with something that's not exactly what they need. I think, I don't know. What do? You got to write a paper, you go to the shelves, and you take what's there, unless you're really, you've started ahead of time. The other thing is you can't have a library without staff. And all of the newer kinds of information resources that are electronic take a fair amount of staff assistance to use. You can't just walk in and search those online databases yourself. So we're going to have this expanding request from people, I think, for more help in using electronic information, for combining electronic information services with what's in the collection already, with a stable staff size. And I think the only way that we're going to be able to deal with it as a library staff is to really go through some soul searching and figure out what we can quit doing. I went to Pittsburgh last week and gave a paper on the psychology of librarianship. Because I think it's changing. The notion that we've had up to this time, well, one of them is really easy. You know, one notion is that we are here to teach you how to find things for yourself. We're not exactly going to get involved in the content of what's there, except to get it to you kind of broadly. And catalogs are pretty much self-help mechanisms. Well, with electronic information, it takes more analysis. It takes much more discussion between me and you about what you want. Mm. It takes more analysis on my part of the content so that I can tell if I'm getting close to what you want. And when you've got a search that returns 200 or 400 or 500 or 1,000 items and you don't want that many items, then we have to have some discussions about what you really do want. Well, there you're talking about, you know, 2 hours per search. On a normal reference desk, if you did a 2-hour question for somebody, you'd feel that you'd really slight it everybody else that came for help. And I think that we now can't go on the assumption that we can meet everybody's needs. What we have to do is go on the assumption that we have to meet the most important needs. And those are not often the needs that just drop in. They're going to be the needs where you know what the research is that the faculty member is doing, or where you're working with a group of graduate students. Undergraduates might be drop-in, but... And librarians aren't set up right yet psychologically, I think, to handle that. It also requires you to look...
You mean to turn people down and make choices.
Right. Mm-hmm. It requires you to look ahead, to look long-term. Mm-hmm. And right now, we pretty much look short-term all the time. One of the requests that Bernie Cohen made of me last week was to try to give Donna Shalala some recommendations on what to do for library support in response to whatever the system committee is going to recommend. And I think I'm going to recommend to her trying to build now some percentage higher in the book budget to see if she can get them to go up a little more in the book budget. But let's go on the assumption that we're not going to have the collections that we need to support the programs here for the next 3 years at least, maybe for the next 5 years. And so what can we do to make better advantage of what we have now? And that's to establish some telefacsimile networks, some electronic information networks, so that if we can get some of this in electronic databases rather than buying the book, that we could get it and deliver it on demand.
Hmm.
And to try to lay the base for that in the equipment in establishing the network, the phone network and the linkages, and in trying to get staff reoriented to that kind of thinking. Concentrate on bibliographic instruction so that we only have to deal with most people once or twice, so that they're pretty much self-sufficient for their minimum needs, and then try to find the people who need the most help and do triage. Mm-hmm. And if in the triage your research isn't as important as X's research and X can't come up with any more money, we're going to be making choices, I think, between who we'll help and who we won't help. Kind of gloomy, isn't it?
Yes.
Actually. But I don't know what else we can do. I mean, other than that, we should just settle in for being mediocre until it gets so bad that people get absolutely irate and upset and it seems to be harming the state. In which case, then maybe it'll cycle around if it's like other states.
Is the faculty making an audible fuss about this? I mean, to the chancellor about the system, the way they did about the salaries?
Not the way they did about the salaries. No. Some departments are writing letters now. Meteorology, math, German, Greek and Latin, classics, the classics department. But what they're doing right now is they're writing to me with a copy to the chancellor, or else they write to the chancellor with a copy to me, asking for a bigger portion of the money that's here already.
Oh.
And now, it wouldn't, you'd think that you could say, no, we got to have new money. But that doesn't, this campus, I don't think this campus is set up to have, I honestly don't know why that is. I don't know why faculty aren't really upset unless they're getting what they need, and if they're getting what they need, then I guess we're doing okay, except we're just not getting what we think we need. But how can you not get what you think you need when you're only buying 20% of the scholarly publication that's available? I guess that's, you can make do short term, but the harm comes over the long haul. And I think the harm is surely now happening over the long haul, because we won't be able to go back. Monographs go out of print. Serial runs go out of print, so you can't get back issues. And we're not getting at all the kind of electronic information resources that are available. And that's a real shame, because that's new patterns of scholarship. And I don't think if we don't lay the groundwork now for electronic information, it takes so long to build the equipment base and the staff base. Very hard to pick up if we got a big influx of money, we would surely spend it, but we would spend it pretty fast. And I don't think it would be harder to spend it on electronic things. We're just not ready yet.
Do you have any regents working for you?
Excuse me. In my opinion, no. Mm-hmm. There are no regents that I've heard talk about library needs. And the way that the politics work here, although I'm more comfortable about this now, but generally, I present a case to the campus, the campus presents the case to system, I present a case to system, and system goes to the regents. Mm-hmm. Donna may work that differently, because of course you can work that differently. You can go through the right channels, but you can also talk to people that you know on the side. And I've been here long enough now that I would be more comfortable about doing that. I wasn't for mm-hmm. the first 3 years here. You know, you got to get your going through the channels done right first. But now I wouldn't hesitate to go and talk to somebody about more money for libraries.
Who?
Well, if I had a chance, I would talk to any legislator and I would talk to any regent about it. I can't make appointments to go and talk to them about it. I have to run into them.
Yeah.
Or I have to know somebody who knows them mm-hmm. and have a chance to talk to them about it. Because, of course, you can't shortcut the campus priorities. And so you've got to figure out where you are. And that's why Donna should be opening some doors, because she has as a high visible campus priority libraries. And that makes it much, much easier to work around on the sides to help build that idea.
And you're hoping that that's the case, definitely.
Yes, yes.
You're not entirely sure about that.
Well, she is surely saying that mm-hmm. in public meetings. And we did get mid-year funding for NLS this year, so that the budget is fixed for this year. And I think that's a large part. I attribute that to her. Mm-hmm. You have to see, I'm waiting for this first year of budgeting to see what the campus priorities end up being and how she wants to turn her priority for libraries into actual budget priorities along with everything else. She's talking too about faculty catch-up. Mm. And system is talking about supplies and equipment. So if you take all that money for faculty catch-up and you take money for supplies and equipment, and then you take, you know, 4 or 5 million for libraries. I, honest to God, though, Laura, what's 4 million out of whatever the system budget is? And how can you have, well, I guess you can. I was going to say, how can you have highly successful and vigorous faculty members with good graduate students and a sound undergraduate program, and not enough copies of anything to read, or no title at all. Beats me. Beats me. We sit and puzzle over it right now. I'm thinking whether or not we're saying the message right to the campus about it, or making enough noise, or pushing hard enough. And I don't know.
I suppose you need a reporter from one of the newspapers to run a series.
I think it would have to be a series. Gardner Selby, before he, for the Cap Times, before he left and took another job, wrote about the library collections. It was really a good article. It scared us all because he went and talked to everybody, and we were sure we were going to get knocked again. And but it was a good article. But nothing happened. Mm. I'm waiting to see if anything will happen from all the frou-frou in Milwaukee.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, Milwaukee wants money for its library now. How did that affect you then?
Well, that's a hard one to balance, Laura, because on the one hand, it's good that the faculty there are upset. You know, it's good that they're petitioning the chancellor. From the library perspective, it may not be good from the campus perspective, but from the library perspective, it's good that it's getting in the press. Mm-hmm. It's not good that Bill Rozelle, in building his budget requests, asks for twice as much as I think we could ever justify asking for. And I haven't quite figured out how to balance that yet. Because we're writing a joint letter to the chancellors asking for special support for the Madison and Milwaukee campuses. And I'm drafting it, and I have not done it yet because I can't figure out how I'm going to balance the fact that I'm asking for half as much as he's asking for, but I couldn't justify asking for twice as much as he's asking for, which is what would normally be the case. Because I don't think he's being realistic in what he's asking for.
Well, surely you'll have to ask for twice as much, even if it means being unrealistic. It would look very bad if especially with when Milwaukee has its legislators that are always ready to dig in and help.
Yeah. Well, then I lose all my credit because I've told Bernie. I've told Bernie here how much we need, and we wrote a paper for Shalala when she came about how much we really need. And I've always believed in realistic requests. You might put a little extra in it because you know you're going to lose in the negotiations a little bit. So I've got already this groundwork laid with, you know, we need $1 million more this year because we've lost that in buying power. We probably need, that's this fiscal year. We need another $750 on top of that next fiscal year. Well, we're not going to get either of them. Okay, so instead of $1,750,000, we're going to get $350,000 or something like that. So then we'll come to the biennium, over $1 million behind already, but we will already have experienced another year of decreasing purchasing power. So maybe we're up again to $200 million that we're behind. So I could justify asking for $400 million. Bill's asking for $400 million. And I haven't figured out how to do that. I thought I'd talk to Bernie about it this week and see how he wanted to handle that kind of a joint letter. Actually, I could just write the letter and not put any sums in it. Maybe that's what I'll do. And then tell Bill I didn't put any sums in it, and if we get a pro or any kind of a tentative yes to that, we could talk about how much to really ask for.
But you're on reasonably good terms with him.
Yes, yeah. Guarded always, because I mean, we're on good terms when we're going for something together. And sometimes we're not on such good terms when we're fighting for the same pot of money. NLS was a good example of that. The campus there hasn't put anything into into its library computing, a small amount of money. And so he's starting much farther back. I mean, the campus has built a fairly decent base here. $688,000 isn't anything to sneeze at. So again, he's going to ask for twice as much or three times as much for NLS as I will, because the campus has put more money into it. 2 years ago, when there was only one pot of money that we were asking for from System for one-time funding support for it, Bill was uncomfortable with being in NLS, and he thought he saw an opportunity to drop out altogether and get what he viewed as his pot of the his share of the System pot for a separate system, for something else. And he had the gall to call me, and this was after we had really fought pretty long and hard to get through the fact that NLS was going to work, and we had to back it, and we were putting an enormous amount of effort into it. He called to say that he saw this as an opportunity to meet their special needs there. Would I support him in asking for his share of the money for something else? And I told him I wouldn't. If he wanted to try and get it, he could go ahead, but I wasn't going to say that NLS wasn't the thing that we should both be doing. Mm-hmm. And I think I thought it was, so that made it easy to say. So he went and asked for it, and we have these tentative little talks with people at System. Elwin Kamik, who is a fine man and helps parcel out this money, we went and had a nice talk with him, and he sort of got my feathers pushed down a little bit, because I was pretty angry, and he got Bill pretty much back on the track. No, you really can't have this money. It's only if you want to participate in NLS, then you can have it for NLS. And since then, we've gotten along quite well. And he's on this thing with getting the faculty going. He's called a number of times because it's very dangerous. You know, it can look like you're trying to manipulate the chancellor by getting the faculty all upset. And I think, gosh, I can think of any number of people who have gotten into the same situation, and they immediately call all their friends for help. You know, am I doing the right thing? Am I going too far? If you're in the same state, will you back me up? And so you always have to be a little careful about how far you push people, because again, if it's not a campus priority, you're part of the campus team. On the other hand, you're supposed to push for what your responsibility is, but on the other hand, you're still part of the campus team. And so he's still worried that he's pushing too far, and he's trying to set it up so that the faculty are taking the initiative, and they are. And I think it's a darn good message. If I had an opportunity to carry the message here in a more public way, we'd probably be saying exactly the same things.
Except it sounds to me as if you lose by it. If this is a good message,
We easily could. They can end up with more money, Laura. Mm-hmm. It's real, because you can't. Sometimes those legislators do such irrational things. They micromanage. Mm-hmm. There could easily be a component in the budget package that says Milwaukee gets $4 million and Madison gets X. Yeah. You know, it could turn out to be like that. And President Shaw and Donna and Chancellor Shalala have got to know how to try to work that stuff. But I surely can't second guess both of them. And he's also more desperate because the campus hasn't supported them the same way the campus has here. And so if you don't think you're going to get any support from the chancellor and you're not getting any support from the vice chancellor, it's almost, what are your choices? Well, you can fight really hard or you can leave. And you may end up leaving after you fought really hard too, but the alternative is just so frustrating. And that's what he said. He just couldn't take it anymore. I'm not that frustrated yet. Now, I might have been if Irv was still here, but I think I think that with her, at least talking libraries were much ahead of the game.
You mean he wouldn't have spoken? Oh, that's right. He even cut the library buying budget, didn't he? But that was.
That was political.
Yes, but political.
Yeah,
yes.
That was, and yeah, he would support it, but he wouldn't support it big.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about nickels and dimes, and we're really talking about what's needed now is millions of dollars. Kind of boggles the mind, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Think you're in charge of something that's spending millions of dollars every year, and don't even see it. You know, it's just numbers on paper. It comes in and it goes out. But sometimes I stop and think about that when I think, well, why are you complaining? They say, because we got $1 million this year. And I say, $1 million, it's a drop in the bucket. And they say, $1 million is $1 million. That's a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money. But you have to spend that kind of money. Especially on something like this, because you can't make up for it any other way. So Dave Cronin is absolutely right, I think. The other thing that he has, and which almost all of the deans have who have active researchers, is he has an overhead pool. $1 million, it's a drop in the bucket. And they say $1 million is $1 million. That's a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money. But you have to spend that kind of money. Especially on something like this, because you can't make up for it any other way. So Dave Cronin is absolutely right, I think. The other thing that he has, and which almost all of the deans have who have active researchers, is he has an overhead pool of money. And he also has a very large area to, I mean, his budget is $60 million or something like that. Well, when he's got that many units in L&S, when they have a vacancy in a position, he keeps the salary saving.
Hold on a moment. Okay.
So he can generate a pool of money to put in priority areas. I do much better than, say, Virginia Holst in Health Sciences, you know, where she's got 17 people who work there. She hardly has any flexibility at all. But deans generally end up with more flexibility in terms of trying to meet some needs. And they get more of the overhead that comes straight back to them. And we get whatever portion seems appropriate to whoever's making those decisions. The other thing is, we got all these books and no place to put them. I don't know.
Don't say that. They'll notice I don't buy so many books.
Well, that's exactly right. It's a good thing you're in a in a deficit situation. You didn't have any place to put them. Actually, we think about what would happen if Donna was successful in getting $10 million endowment or $10 million in a steady flow of money coming in. You know, we'd have to have more places to put them, and then you have to have more staff because you have to have more people to process the money and to process the books. And you have to try to keep it in balance a little bit. But I would never say no to the money.
Mm.
I think library directors have more constituencies too. I don't know if we talked about this last time. Faculty members want one thing. Often different faculty members contradict each other in what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Students want something. The administration wants something. The general citizenry wants something. And many of them are superficial, and so it's not very hard to not answer all of them. But some of them are pretty substantive. And I don't know how deans deal with that, or if they have that kind of varied constituency that they have to respond to all the time.
But you're saying you have just one constituency.
No, we have many.
You have many.
Many. I have the students who want longer library hours, okay. Undergraduates. Graduate students want longer library hours and better collections and more staff. Mm-hmm. Faculty members want libraries right near where they are, mm-hmm. and they would like to have delivery services, they would like more collections, and they would all like to have their own individual departmental library. And and Bernie would like everything to go smoothly. And last 2 weeks ago when I went to talk to him, I said, you know, Bernie, what am I going to do? I got all these people who want more books, and I don't, what am I going to do? He said, well, have you thought about reallocation? And there is no magic in reallocation. And so I, you know, we talked it over a little bit. There isn't anything to reallocate. Can you reallocate a $60,000 supply and equipment budget and have it turn into anything? No. We already don't have enough chairs to sit on, you know. So Bernie wants things to go well.
That's an interesting statement. Does this mean that he doesn't want to know if they're not going well? Or?
No, he does want to know if they're not going well. But he doesn't want to have to, I mean, it's my responsibility to solve problems. Mm. He helps me solve those problems, but by and large, I try not to go to him with anything that's insoluble. I mean, there should be something that I need help on, but I should be able to figure out how to do most of it. Mm-hmm. What I can't figure out is how to make bricks without straw. And that's the big thing that I can't solve. I can solve almost everything else. I mean, I can deal with all the personnel issues. I can deal with all the faculty relationships. I can deal with the fundraising. I can deal to a degree with the student requests for library hours, extended library hours. I can even sort of gen up getting the kind of financial support for the network library system, but I can't make money for books. And so when you say that, then I've given him something that I can't solve. Mm-hmm. Now Donna doesn't expect me to be able to solve that, and that's the great relief. You know, I expect from her that I'm either going to get a yes or a no. I'm either going to get a yes, there's some money, or no, there's no money. And now you know what to do. With Irv, you never quite knew what was yes and what was no. And every so often you'd get into this deep pit someplace, and then there would be some money. You know, he would come and bail people out. Well, that's not how I like to be managed. Mm. It's not how I like to manage.
I didn't know.
Yeah. So, the collection, I don't know, the collection is so central. And we can even make up with it with resource sharing, and we can make up with it with trying to do different things with electronic information to take the place of the collection. But when you get right to the point where you don't have any collection, then there's no collection, and there isn't anything left. And you can't build a fundraising base in 3 years. You have to build a fundraising base over a lot longer period of time.
Do the deans speak up for you?
Dave does. Dave Cronin does. Cliff Thompson has the law library as part of his responsibility, and he is speaking up for the law library now, though he's not allocating any money into it himself. And that's the other thing that happens often here, Laura. It's that Bernie will say, well, why don't you go and talk to some of the deans? So I'll go off and I'll talk to some of the deans, and they'll say, no, 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 this is not my responsibility to fund libraries. This is the state's responsibility to fund libraries. So then I go back to Bernie and I say, Bernie, they say, no, no, no. And he kind of shakes his head. But you know, the feeling is that the deans have the money.
I see. So Dave set a dangerous precedent for
that. Yes. Well, he said he would never do it again. Uh-huh. He said it was a one-time thing and he would never do it again. And I haven't asked him because I don't want him to do it, as a matter of fact. I think if the best of all possible worlds is that the campus figure out what it's going to fund centrally and then fund it and just don't give as much money to everybody else. Rather than saying we're going to try to do it both ways, we're going to fund it centrally, but yes, maybe you should go off and try to drum up some interest from the deans and they'll put money into it. Well, they won't. I mean, I'm not going to. Dave did it because he was real concerned and he knew there was no other solution for it. But he's not going to start spending all of his budget on library collections. He won't get any points for that. And he won't get any more money to make up for it. Mm-hmm. Hell of a thing, isn't it?
Well, you've certainly expressed it very clearly. I mean, it's the whole story. I think it'll be interesting to hear what happens. Well, shall we go back?
Okay. Shall we try from the top?
Yes.
Or should we try from the bottom?
I've forgotten what the bottom is. We're circling around to the next bigger circle, which is when you came here, what you knew about what was going on and how you were introduced to the whole situation and what you thought about it.
Irv called me and asked me to apply, and I had sent my name in when I was at Alabama. I had sent my name in, but I didn't expect anything to come of it. And months passed, and I think it took them a long time to have the search. In fact, I know it took them a long time to have the search, and there was a lot of rumor and gossip going on in library circles about what was happening with the search. And Virginia Thomas, who was in Irv's office at that time, has told me repeatedly that library grapevines are incredible and that librarians know all about everybody, and they apparently tried to really tap into the grapevine and they tried to get advice about, you know, who to hire and what was up and everything like that. So he called me. I mean, he himself called me. I was just as impressed as I could be by the whole thing. And he said they had two candidates, and I was one of them, and would I come up for an interview? And I said I would be pleased and honored to come for an interview. And so he sent me a copy of the Percy Report for as part of the getting ready for the interview. And also I talked to Beverly Lynch, who's at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And I talked to Sue Brinteson, who's at the University of Delaware, who's the director there, and she used to work here. Mm. And she keeps up with, or at least she did keep up with Wisconsin things. And Beverly was thinking about being a candidate herself. And so I called them, and we had a big library meeting right before I came here to interview. I gave a paper in Seattle because Association of College and Research Libraries met in Seattle right before I came here, and I gave the keynote paper on myths and realities, research librarianship. Well, everybody was there, and so I had a chance to talk to Beverly, and I had a chance to talk to Sue, and I talked to a couple of other people. They said it's a cesspool. They don't know what they want. They won't support anybody. They won't support faculty rank for librarians. You know, they've had this crazy study. Well, admittedly, when you read the Percy Report, it looks like it's from outer space. Mm. You know, I read it and I thought, what is this man doing here? And so I thought, well, I'll just go and see what it's like. And it seemed to me very clear that the librarians were really bitter and angry. They were glad Jill was gone. They, you know, not they being everybody, but there was a feeling of, it ranged from relief to great glee that they got rid of Joe. They thought that the Fowler and the Percy reports were both penetrating. And when I got up here, I asked for a copy of the Fowler report, and I honestly think he could have sued. I think that was libelous, what they did, and the comments that they made about him in that report. You can say the same things without using words like fascist and things like that. Just shocking that a faculty committee would do a report like that. And, you know, there were all kinds of bickerings. It was not a united staff at all. People didn't talk to each other. There were divisions between the branch libraries and the central library. There was no middle management. There were people who were department heads who were, you know, clearly not probably going to do very well in the jobs that they had. The faculty members that I met, I thought were reasonable. Marion O'Leary was on the search committee, and we had real good talks about what needed to be done. I can remember I met Richard Knowles. He had a cold, and he had just gotten back the day before from England, and he was quite like this, you know. And I thought, well, here's another snooty faculty member. Turns out to be one of the nicest fellows, you know. Nancy Marshall was here, and Nancy and I have been off and on colleagues because of networking, libraries and networking in OCLC for a long time. And it was very hard on her that I was coming here to interview. And in fact, she was really quite upset about the whole thing, because she had wanted to be a candidate and she was not being interviewed. So there was this whole business over here of, I'd ask for something and she'd say, well, if you're the successful candidate, we'll share that information with you. It was, you know, really interesting. And she had gotten sideways, I think, with Irv and with other people up in Bascom Hall, and so I was getting a lot from that side about, well, what do you really think about Nancy and how she's done things? And I thought, I thought, well, you know, there sure is a lot about this that's right in terms of what Beverly and Susan said. But there was a lot that was ready to happen. You know, you'd had all of the beginning of the catharsis. Everything that had been that needed to be studied had been studied. You know, you could look at the Percy report and know exactly what to do in coming. It was an agenda that was laid out, and if you followed it, you were bound to solve most of the problems, particularly the problems that people felt most strongly about. Irv seemed supportive, and I'd never go any place unless I thought I could work with the chancellor. You know, you can't make up for that by having good staff relations or anything like that. The people in Bascom seemed supportive because they had a very big problem with their computing, and I am very good in computing. And so I think they were looking for answers, too, and they were looking for somebody who could get them out of what they perceived to be a hole with the computing. And I don't know what they thought they needed on the staff side, but clearly they had all these disaffected people who had made a lot of public trouble. And they had to be looking for somebody that they thought could meet all of those needs. So I did the interview, and I can remember saying something incredibly stupid. Irv had me to dinner with some of the search committee, and so John Palmer was there, and who else? There was another dean there, and somebody else was there. And he asked me what I thought a library director was, and I said a library director is a technocrat, because at that point that's what I was thinking that a library director was. You do so many technocratic things all of the time. Well, Irv didn't like that answer too much, you know, so our discussion sort of went downhill from that. And I went home, and I was just puzzling over it, because I was interviewing at LSU at the same time. And they had a new president, they had a new vice chancellor for academic affairs who was a woman. They had all the oil money that they could think of how to spend. They wanted to bring LSU up very quickly, and they were going to put a lot of money into the library, and they wanted me to come in the worst way. And so that's, you know, LSU is not a shabby place. It's not Madison, but it's not shabby. So I thought, well, I'll just wait and see. And so the day after I got back from my second visit to LSU, Irv called again. He said, well, we'd like you to come back for a second visit. And so I said, okay. I thought I'd come back for a second visit. And I called around again a little more, but I talked to Dick Doherty, who's at Michigan, and to Hugh Atkinson, because I'd already figured out what I needed to know from Beverly. And I decided that their problems were very significant here, and it was going to take a lot of work, but pretty much the path was all laid out. Pretty much all you could do was to go up in terms of accomplishing things. And Irv spent, on that second visit, 4 hours talking to me. We sat for a whole afternoon in his office, and I thought by the time I finished that talk that I understood pretty much what he wanted. I thought I'd really been thinking about it, because I also had a few doubts about whether or not I could do it. It's significantly bigger than Alabama, and the faculty are intimidating, just in terms of the Alabama faculty members, by and large, weren't researchers. And so the faculty here is kind of intimidating in that regard. But finally, at the end of the interview with him, he said, well, you think you can do it, don't you? And I said, yes, I've really been thinking about it, and I think I can do it. And then we talked a little bit about, you know, how much money would I want if I came. And I had an amount that I knew that I wanted if I came, which was higher than I think he expected. And but I also was getting ready to interview for a job in California that would have been in the middle 70s, and so I knew what I wanted to ask for, because I had a couple of choices, and I could have gotten that pretty much from LSU, too. And I asked him about collection support and support for NLS, because I needed those. He had made a commitment of staff support for the cataloging and the backlog, so I didn't really need to ask for staff support at that point. And then I left. And in 2 days, he called and made the offer, and I said I'd think it over. And I went and talked to the president at Alabama, and Irv had already called him. And so they had a little chat about it, and so Joab knew already. And I came.
Why did you choose Madison rather than LSU or California?
Well, I chose Madison over LSU because Madison is much more the research university. And also, the staff at LSU was a lot like the staff at Alabama. Some nice people, some not so nice people, competent people, but nothing exciting. And the staff here, for all their fractiousness, were so solid. I mean, just excellent people, one after the other here. The California job was a job at the California System Office. And automation. And every so often I think that I'll leave being a director of a library and go into a staff position. Mm. And every time I get ready to do that, Atkinson would say, no, okay. You don't want, you're a librarian. Yeah. And I'd say, okay, Hugh, you're right, I'm a librarian. So I decided not to do the staff thing and then at California, and then the staff here was so good. And then the fact is that it's, LSU must be something in the 50s or so in size and research libraries. And this is always 12th or 13th, and it's just more exciting if it's bigger. Mm-hmm. I met with the bibliographers that are all housed in this building, Suzanne Hodgman and Chester Wang and Dave Hennig and Alex Rolich and Jack Wells and Irwin, Yvonne Schofer. And they were fighting with each other while we interviewed, while I was talking to them. You know, I was just sort of watching this go back and forth. And I was trying to get them to tell me what they needed, because I was getting ready then, right after that, to go and talk to Irv. And I wanted to know what they needed so I could go and ask for it. God damn it, they couldn't come up with anything. And Dave Hennig was sitting there, and I thought, now this guy is somebody that you need to keep an eye on, because he's smart and he's sharp. And he was watching this go back and forth, and finally he said, look, we need to tell her what we want. So then they allowed us how they could use some extra collection money, maybe, and some staff wouldn't hurt, sort of. So when I came, I thought, well, now what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to lay this out when I come? And I thought with the staff, the most important thing I wanted to do was to get them to trust me. And so that meant that I needed to meet with a lot of them. And that was easy to do because they all reported to me. 35 people reported to me. Joe didn't have any middle management at all. Even some of the people who reported to department heads reported to me. Mm. And then I thought I would try to set up some meetings with people. And so we started some group meetings, and that I would get to know Frank, because he was an assistant director. Sandy I had already talked to a couple of times, and I knew that she was really good. Nancy was problematical because she still hadn't quite resolved how she felt about me coming and how she was going to work for me. In fact, she called one day before I was getting ready to come, and she had moved into this office when she took over as the acting director, and she wanted to know if she could stay here and I could move into the office that she had had when I came so that she wouldn't have to move. And I told her no, she had to move. It was just too symbolic.
Yes.
To let it go. Well, Nancy tried stuff like that every so often. So I started meeting with everybody. And then I also needed to meet with the faculty, and I started making visits to department chairs. The University Library Committee had been newly formed, and they didn't know exactly what they were doing because it was a new charge. And so we had a really active first year with that group, and Marion O'Leary was chairing it then, and he really chaired it. I didn't in any way run it. I was there, and that I like it when it's that way. I read through the Percy report, and I had outlined the kinds of things that needed to be done. And I started with the people who reported to me on what are we going to do, what are we going to do, and they had already started solving some of the problems. I authenticated some of the committees that were already here, the Equity Action Committee, and asked them to do more. I set up a collection development group that hadn't existed. And then, in the midst of all of that, three things happened, actually. NLS was foundry, and I had to decide whether or not to continue it or to drop it and do something else. The memorial edition was being passed, and then IRV split it into two projects, and that was tough because it put me between the faculty and IRV, because the faculty wanted to really push him hard on it. Mm. And he saw it as a compromise that he had to do, and so I was sort of on the middle of that one. With NLS, I just had to decide what was the right thing to do and then sell it. I hadn't been here but 3 months, and I had to decide about NLS. And then the budget and planning came back and said, look, you've spent less money on books this year than you spent last year, and yet you got a big increase. Where did all that money go? And I said, God, I don't know. I'll go and find out. Are we running out of tape?
Yeah, let's do it. This is tape 3 of the interview with Kay Gaben.
So I got all the budget people together in the room next door, and I said, now look, what did you do? And it took them 2 days, Laura, of sitting down and working through their individual notes to figure out that they'd gotten this big increase in the book budget, and they had allocated almost all of it to operating expenses because they had big needs. Percy was encouraging Nancy to do that, and it was Nancy's inclination to do it anyway. She felt that the place was underfunded, and she was just going to get the money to where it needed to be. And so she did. And so we identified $167,000 that needed to be taken out of the operating budget and put back into the collection budget. And that was our first big financial crisis. And that was just 3 months after I had been here. So I had NLS, I had the building, and I had the financial. So I went back to everybody and look, I said, we've got to get $167,000 out of the operating budget. What can we cut? So we had these big discussions about what we could cut. And I can't even remember now what we cut. But anyway, we cut it and we put it back into the book budget. And then we had a big discussion after we put it into the book budget about how it would be allocated amongst all of the selectors. And this is an enormous bone of contention, how much money they get out of the pot to spend. And I told them we would not use the formula that was in place because it hadn't been changed for 10 years and we had to start thinking more creatively. And I got a group of selectors together and they worked really hard, and then we finally figured out a way to spend $167,000 that wasn't to allocate a little piece to everybody. But that was a very important symbol for the selectors because it showed them clearly immediately that it wasn't going to be business as usual. And it set up a tension, which I view as a healthy tension and which makes them nervous, because it's very difficult for them to think about trying to agree on new ways to allocate the book budget. It sent a message to all of the people who were involved in those decisions here that they could not make those decisions, and furthermore that it took them 2 days to figure out how they had done it, that there had to be better bookkeeping and administrative support here. It sent a very tough message to Nancy, because at the same time that we were doing that and she was explaining how she'd gotten into it, I had to tell her that she did not have the respect and had not had the respect of IRV and the other administrators, and they hadn't bothered to tell her. And they hadn't, you know. They just felt it, but they never did come back and tell her that they thought she wasn't doing the right thing. So how could she know? Mm. Furthermore, Don Percy was down here encouraging her to do some things and obviously never going back and telling IRV that he was telling Nancy to do these things. But that very much hurt her, that Yes.
Well, I was just wondering, what was his, he'd finished with the report, was he?
Well, he stayed on for a little bit.
Oh.
Or else a lot of that decision making occurred while he was gathering the information to write the report.
Hmm.
So he, I think during the whole budgeting period before I got here, he was here and he was giving her advice about things.
Which you would have assumed came from Earth, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. And
so that wasn't very useful then from him.
No, it was not.
Mm.
I think in fact it was really inappropriate.
Mm.
I mean, it's one thing if he does it and he goes back and tells Irv what he's encouraging Nancy to do. or that he not encourage Nancy and he let her find her own way. But to encourage her to do some of those things and then not to tell Irv and then to leave, particularly with Nancy, who didn't need much encouragement to do those things, and then she thought she was responding to what they wanted to have happen. They told her to be tougher about the NLS development. And so she got into long memo battles with Jack Dewey and with Glenn Watts about the funding of NLS. And come to find out, nobody wanted to have long memo battles. They didn't want her to be tough that way. They wanted her to be on top of it, which is, there's a subtle difference there, you know. It's like, it's what I was saying earlier, it's don't make trouble. Solve the problems. You know, starting a memo battle doesn't solve the problems. So we were all, you know, everybody was being good to me and I was trying to be good to them and we were getting to know each other. And we had a budgeting session at that same time, and so we had a chance to work through the first round of budgeting for the biennium. And that was useful because I got to say things about the collection and NLS.
Is this still the 35 people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So then we were exploring how to reorganize. And it was a little difficult because Nancy's title was associate director and she didn't want to change. And Frank was the only other assistant director, and Sandy Fahler was here in personnel. And then there were a bunch of department heads. So in reorganizing, I can't even remember now how. Anyway, we had a plan, hammered out this plan through a lot of discussion about what was good to put together. And there was an executive group of representatives of each of the primary areas in the library. So there was one from the member libraries, and there was one from the bibliographers. And there must have been about 8 people on that committee. So we sort of hammered out this approach that we were going to take and hired Nolan Pope in the first 9 months that I was here because there was nobody here for automation. Advertised for the position that Lou Pitchman has now because there was nobody here to oversee collection development. And had a fairly divisive thing happen at about the end of the first year when the librarians were going to do a titling activity, the one before Hayes Hill. And that was all set and in place by the time that I got here, but the criteria for determining which title the librarian should have hadn't been formed at all. And I've been through...
Now, you talked about this last time.
Last time, right.
Would you like to see what you said?
No, I'll just gloss over it.
All right.
Basically, what happened was after the criteria applied, fairly stringently, there were people who were not at the title that they thought they should be at. And that was divisive. And it's, I mean, there are still remnants of that left over now. That happened, and then we had the state budget repair bill, and with the state budget repair bill, everything that we had been working on just turned around. It simply turned around. The reorganization that we were going to do didn't fit anymore, and we needed a completely new organizational structure if we were going to have 27 fewer people. And so in looking at that new organizational structure, all of the people that I didn't have reporting to me ended up coming into place. And now there are, 13 or 14 people. So there's a nice layer of middle management. But in that reorganization, almost everybody ended up in a new organizational component of the general library system. But with that kind of impact on people, at the same time there were other things going on. We hired Nolan. The network library system seemed very viable then at that point. It was getting more viable, so we implemented it. It worked okay. And not only did it work okay, but every year it keeps working a little better. We started a staff development program, which was one of the things that the Percy Report called for. There needed to be collection coordinator, and so that person was hired. There needed to be an automation person, and that person was hired. There needed to be more online searching being done. And every year for the last 3 years, we've added microcomputers and a training budget and subsidies to get more online searching started. People didn't believe that they needed to have a microcomputer for just normal work. Why didn't we put that money into something else, like staff? But I continued to buy microcomputers, and that's created a revolution. There's more creativity going on right now through the use of microcomputers and their applications to library problems than you can shake a stick at. People are really excited about it. So we started to do more online searching. We got through the titling activity. We got all of the salaries in balance. That had been one of the criticisms from the Percy Report, that the salaries were not in balance for the level of responsibility that people had. And that's really true. They were not. And so now pretty much all of the salaries are in balance. Another item in the Percy Report was that we needed to have better collection development control. And Lou now has been here almost 2 years, and he's really getting to people pulled together and examining their collection policies and looking at what they buy and experimenting with different ways to allocate the collection budget. When I came, I tried to keep a contingency fund of $30,000 for the collection development, and it met with great worry that somehow I was going to be giving this money away to people and there wouldn't be a fair chance for everybody to get their cut of it. This year, Lou had a contingency fund of $100,000 and people didn't even bat an eyelash at it. And he's allocating it where it's needed. He's not allocating it evenly distributed to everybody. There were criticisms in the Percy Report about responsiveness to campus needs, that we weren't responding to the needs of faculty members in collections and just generally in listening to them. And I don't hear that now. I don't actually think anything has changed there, except the librarians feel better about it. And I think in their communication with faculty members, then everybody feels better about it. And it's much easier for them to bring things back now and have them done. There was something in the Percy Report about Joe's relationships with the two unions. There's a blue-collar union and a white-collar union here. And when the union people would come in, he'd give them anything they wanted in order to try to keep them quiet. And of course, they were just running all over people. And I just stopped that. We read the contract. We follow the contract. We do the things we're supposed to be doing. I don't give them any more than they're supposed to have. I respect them. They respect me. And I don't think we've had but three or four grievances since I've been here. Even when we went through the reorganization where we transferred 17 represented staff members to different work responsibilities, we didn't get a grievance. We worked very closely with the unions in trying to work through that. So the union activities are all on a balance, and in fact, they're quite pleased now because we're expanding the responsibilities of the classified staff members every day. Technical services people are working in public services. Public services people are working with technical services operations. NLS does that. And this year we reviewed all of the position responsibilities for the classified staff to see how they had changed either from the reorganization or from automation. And we submitted 15 requests for reclassification, and they all passed. And we'll do it again every year now until we're done with the automation, because they'll keep changing for the next 2 or 3 years. So people have upward mobility that they didn't have before. What I think I read over the Percy report, I read it every year to see how we're doing. There isn't anything left. There wasn't anything left in the Percy report 2 years ago that either wasn't fixed or wasn't ready to be addressed. And the problems that we have today are all new problems. And that's the way that it should be, I think. In all of that, though, there were a couple of things that continued to be themes. One theme that was that Bernie was very supportive through the whole thing. He's just supportive as an individual and understanding it, and easy to relate library issues to academic issues with Bernie. A second one was that I never had anything to do with Irv after I came, except to see him in meetings. I never met with him. I never talked to him. He got a little angry with me when I cut the library hours as part of the budget cuts.
he called you about it?
No. I told him before what I was going to do. I mean, I knew what was going to happen. And I sent him three memos telling him what was going to happen. And Paul Ginsberg told him what was going to happen. And he didn't tell me not to do it. And I went ahead and did it, and it all happened. And he got a lot of embarrassing phone calls and so forth from it. And then he put the money back into the budget. And then he took it away the next year. But I think the theme that runs through all of that is that for the director, the director is to take care of the directing, and I would do that again with Irv. I mean, if something like that came up again, I don't believe you should make all of your cuts behind the scenes so that nobody ever knows. Mm-hmm. And I would do that again. I would probably do it differently with Donna than I would do it with Irv. But I pretty much, I think, can solve or resolve the things that I'm supposed to in terms of campus relationships. I think what's happening inside the libraries is a period now of real ferment and growth. And always in that, you've got people who are under an enormous amount of stress, you know. Implementing a major system at the same time that you're doing titling activities, at the same time that you're asking people to undertake new studies and approaches to things, at the same time that you're giving them a new technology to learn in microcomputing, at the same time that you're cutting the staff and asking them to do the same, because we're still making some management decisions about they're getting us out of the hole of decisions that were made 3 years ago or so. People are under enormous stress. On the other hand, there's an enormous amount of growth going on right now. And it's very hard to separate the stress from that growth from the stress that's normal when you're in a university like this that changes so much, when you're in librarianship, which is changing a great deal right now. I have to tell you, though, Laura, the thing that I have not solved, and I haven't the foggiest glimmer in my mind how I'm going to solve it, is how to get along with the other directors of the professional libraries. Virginia Holston Health Sciences reports to the Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences. Anita Morse, when she was here running the law library, reports to Cliff Thompson, the Dean of Law. Leroy Zweifel reports to John Bollinger, the Dean of Engineering, except for his collection budget, which he gets through me. So he really has, you know, he's got... And then Steenbach report is part of the general library system. When Daisy was here, she ran it as an independent library, only loosely affiliated with the general library system. And those people together with me make up a group called the Library Coordinating Council. And I don't know how to get along with those folks. We have real pecking order conflicts because they're autonomous, and I'm autonomous, but I'm bigger than they are.
Is it like UW-Madison and the other campuses in the system?
Yes, just like. And I speak for libraries. Whenever anybody wants anything in general about libraries, they come to me. They don't go to anybody else. And so I'm constantly speaking for them as well. For planning for the campus, we have such a larger number of people and libraries and programs here that I can go in a direction, and if I'm not thinking about it, you know, just I don't even think about them, and then I wake up and I've done something, and I haven't even told them what I was going to be doing, and they get ticked off by that. On the other hand, they move very slowly. We can work 6 months on a document, never finish it, and we still haven't figured out how to get along. And I'm not sure how I'm going to, I just keep puzzling about that. I can figure out how to get along with the deans. I can figure out how to get along with faculty members. I can even figure out how to get along with undergraduates in the WSA. I cannot figure out how to get along with the LCC people.
Does it matter?
Generally, it doesn't. The one thing that where it does matter is that as more and more parts of the campus get interested in outreach to business, a basis for that is going to be electronic information and some kind of computing-focused information delivery service. And they have fairly active relationships with businesses right now, and they don't want to lose that. On the other hand, they don't want to meld it together in terms of coordinated planning, particularly for fundraising, which is where I'm really interested in it. And so this is one place where it really does make a difference. The other place that makes a difference is in shelving and space. Middleton Library needs more space, and they could not get on the building list for the campus because the Memorial Edition was on it. Neither could law. Now law is getting on through the whole law school. Middleton is still not on, probably won't be on for another biennium now. And she feels quite constrained by that. And there's nothing that she can do there unless I help her. And she won't ask me to help her. And so then she gets more frustrated because she'll go make a presentation, and they'll say, "Have you talked to Kay?" And she'll say, "No," and they'll say, "Well, we're not going to do it then." And then she has to come back, and then we'll have a talk, and then she can't quite figure out how to make that work yet. So it doesn't matter generally, except it matters a little bit. And now it's going to matter a little more because the three deans or the two deans and the vice chancellor are going to start going more to Donna directly. And they're going to say, well, I need more money for the law library. And Bollinger says, I need more money for engineering library. And Noreen says, I need more money for Milton. And that Donna looks at me and I say, well, the general library system is 14 libraries and we need more money. And I don't know how Donna's going to handle that. If she's going to try to deal with each group separately or if she's going to coordinate it. I think
she'll... Would it be possible to put you in charge of the whole thing?
They would never accept it.
Who, the librarians?
Yeah, well, the deans don't want to do it, actually, either. When Bernie had me go and talk to Bollinger and Cliff Thompson this last year, just to put the idea to them, and I did, and neither of them want to do it. People like having... people like having pocket libraries like that, especially when they're big enough to be real libraries. Now, Dave Cronin has umpty-ump small libraries. You know, if he's got 100, he's got 150 of these little reading room small libraries all over the place, and he wants to get rid of them, and he's making every effort to get rid of them. But the other people will not. So at the most, I think maybe Donna will strengthen the coordinating responsibility that I have. And that's one of the other things that's been a little hard, is to try to coordinate people who don't want to be coordinated. I was just talking to Sandy before you came, because we're in the midst now of a small altercation, and I'm trying to think of whether or not I've been fair and all of this, and Sandy said, well, you're fair. I said, well, I think I'm fair. Maybe I'm not really fair. She says, no, you're fair, but they have to be willing to cooperate with you. I said, well, I'm willing to cooperate with them. She says, sure, but they have to be willing to cooperate with you. So I don't know. I don't have any magic insight ball about that. The only thing I know about that, Laura, is that I've read back now through the history of relationships amongst these five people, they've never gotten along. So I'm not any different than from anybody else not getting along. People have, by and large, I think they don't refer back much now to the Percy and Fowler reports, except for this last year when I was getting some amount of internal criticism about low morale and lack of communication and that sort of thing. But and there, then there were allusions back to what this is just like the days of Joe Trey's when we never knew what was going on and so. But now the problem is that people don't know what's going on. Now the problem is that I tell people too much. And too much as not enough, because they can't pick out the pieces that are most important. And the other thing is that people had to get used to reporting to somebody else, and they weren't sure that they liked this middle management layer in here of mostly of young people who are younger than many of them and about the same age as most of them. And they weren't sure. And those people weren't sure how to be good supervisors either. And so during this period over last summer, when some of that library is unfair to workers and all of that business was partly shook people up here a little bit, and they started looking at how they were dealing with people, and now they deal with people differently. You know, they remember that everything I tell them, some of that they have to pass on. The other thing that happens here is that the campus, in following state policies, are you have in this state with the policies that we have to go an extra mile if you have a personnel problem with anybody. You can appeal, and you can appeal again, and the grievance process can be very long, and then you can repeat it again. I mean, you can file as many grievances as you have grievable items. And over this last summer, I have two people who have very strong feelings and of grievance against me. One of them is a person who works in acquisitions, and he came in and he sat right on that sofa and told me that since he couldn't get proper redress through the channels that he was going through, he was going to go to the press. And then 2 weeks after that, this little reporter from the Daily Cardinal shows up with this typed note typed on this fellow's typewriter, because it's a very idiosyncratic typewriter. She showed it to me and I thought, well, here's this anonymous note from guess who. That combined with the fact that Barb Myers in the law library has a grievance about her salary and her title, and she's very unhappy about her salary and her title. And I don't have anything to do with her salary and her title, but I have to do with salaries and titles altogether, and so she's going to continue to pursue that until she gets some kind of redress.